3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio on 8:55 a.m., also streaming live on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au and on the Community Radio Plus app. I'm Rob, and for the next 90 minutes, we'll be bringing you some current affairs from a radical left perspective. But before we get started, of course, 3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present, of the Kulin Nation, and we recognise their unceded sovereignty. As I said before, I'm Rob, and for the next 90 minutes, up until 8:30, we'll be bringing you current affairs from across the world of the radical left. I hope everyone has had a good weekend. It was very rainy yesterday, which is actually kind of nice because I didn't enjoy the hot weather that we've had over the past, I don't know, 10 days or so. It's been, I feel like it's too late in the year to have weather that hot. I sort of just got, it gets to a point where I'm just like, I don't really care to have 27 degrees anymore. Like, I just want normal, nice weather where I can go for a walk. Yesterday was really nice because I just sat on my couch in the backyard and just watched the rain. But hopefully everyone else is stayed dry. I know that there is some more rain expected today, and it will be a bit cooler this week. Maybe I'll just do a quick rundown of all of the content that we have coming up before I get into our news headlines. So we're going to start off the show by hearing a conversation that Jan Bartlett from the Tuesday Hometime show did with Binoy Kampmark, on last Tuesday, and they're talking about the US and Israel's attacks on Iran, Lebanon, and Palestine. And yeah, it was a really interesting conversation because it provides some really good context on sort of how long Netanyahu and Israel have been sort of chipping away at being able to get to the point where they are now, which is to, commit genocide and get away with it on a global stage, even, as they become more and more brazen about what they're doing. So that's happening first up, and that goes for about 20 minutes. So that'll take us through almost until 7:30. And then following that, given it was May Day on Friday, and of course, if you haven't listened to 3CR's May Day broadcast on both Friday and Sunday, you can listen back on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. I thought I'd use it as an excuse to play some archival audio that we were lucky enough to receive from the Australian Queer Archives in St Kilda from 1977, from the 20th of April 1977, from the Gay Liberation radio show, which is hosted by, for those of you who don't know, the Gay Liberation Radio Collective, which is one of the collectives that helped form 3CR, or found 3CR. We'll be listening to that because the host Carl, is speaking with another member of the Gay Liberation Front, Bruce, about being a working class homosexual. Really interesting hearing that, and the parallels between what it's like for me as a queer non-binary person in the workforce, and hearing, to be honest, I don't really know their gender, but given that they use the word homosexual, I'm assuming they're cisgendered men, which actually feels like a bit of a leap, to be honest. But anyway, hearing their experiences as queer people back in the 70s, and yeah, especially they talk a little bit about what it's like being in construction as well, which is also very near and dear to me. And then following that, we'll be hearing the last ever iteration of Tiny Sparks and Turning Points, which is a historical bulletin prepared by our comrades over at the Common Social Change Library, which looks back in history at events that sort of changed the continent, again, from a radical left perspective. So yeah, we'll be excited to hear that. And yeah, as I said before, it's the last ever recurring segment of Tiny Sparks and Turning Points, given that we've been playing it for a year now, actually, which, wow, time flies. So that'll be happening at around 7:45, 8 o'clock, if my maths are correct. And then we'll also be playing the third iteration of another regular segment we have here on the Monday Breakfast Show called The Wing Beats Per Minute, which is all about the importance of insects within ecosystems. This week's episode is focusing on fire ecology, which lines up with quite well with an interview that Hannah did with Phil Zylstra last week. So that'll be playing after 8 o'clock. But for now, we'll just go have a quick little break, and we will get into our headlines. Stay tuned.
Contigo me voy, mi santo, aunque me cueste morir. Tú me quieres dejar, yo no quiero sufrir. Contigo me voy, mi santo, aunque me cueste morir.
CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
The Common Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates, and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
I'm a guy.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. These are the news headlines for Monday, the 4th of May, 2026. Content warning before we get into this first headline that it mentions violence against and murder of Indigenous people. If you feel it may cause distress, tune back in after a few minutes, or you can call Lifeline at 13 11 14, or First Nations people can call 13 Yarn at 13 92 76. Advocacy organisation Cultural Survival has unveiled its advocacy brief, Defending the Land, Paying with Life, analysing the structural violence behind murders of Indigenous land defenders in the context of international human rights. The brief follows the organisation's annual In Memoriam report, which documents the murders of Indigenous land and rights defenders across Latin America last year. The report profiles the 46 Indigenous land defenders who were murdered in 2025, such as Arnaldo Nicolas Romero, an Ajuk person who led resistance against Mexico's interoceanic corridor of the Isthmus of Tehuantepec megaproject. Cultural Survival's report says that the project was, quote, imposed on the Indigenous communities living in that territory, as there was no free, prior, and informed consultation or consent, nor were there any environmental impact studies in the several areas, end quote. Global Witness's 2025 report, Roots of Resistance, documents the 82% of killings and disappearances of Indigenous peoples across the globe were in Latin America. Because of this, Cultural Survival makes several recommendations to states in the region, including the formal recognition of Indigenous people in protecting human rights, the environment, and mitigating climate change, and stigmatization of Indigenous defenders as criminals by associating them with criminal acts such as terrorism, land usurpation, and sedition, and finally, to advance the recognition, demarcation, and protection of Indigenous lands and territories as a means of preventing violence against Indigenous people. You can read the full report at culturalsurvival.org. Also in the news this week, the head of the CFMEU's administration, Mark Irving, KC, resigned last week after almost 2 years in the role. The union was forcefully placed under administration back in August of 2024 in response to the reporting of many still unproven corruption claims by the Australian Financial Review and the Sydney Morning Herald. Most recently, this includes the claim that the union pocketed $15 billion of taxpayer money used to fund the Victorian government's big build projects, which I actually saw this morning that would work out to be every member of the CFMEU, the 30,000 members, would mean they get $500,000 each on top of their union wages, if maths are correct. During Irving's tenure, dozens of democratically elected union officials have been fired without reason or recourse as the administration removed anyone critical of its actions, including Esther Van Arend and Indigenous organiser Joel Shackleton. Mark Irving KC told the ABC that his resignation was due to the administration now entering a, quote, rebuilding phase that requires a different approach. The union is regaining its position in civil society, end quote. And in his place, Irving has delegated running the administration to Michael Crosby, former head of the Actors Union and administration appointed head of the CFMEU's New South Wales branch. I say administration appointed head of the branch because he wasn't democratically elected by rank and file union members. In his resignation, Irving told the Fair Work Commission that the administration now needs a, quote, experienced union professional, end quote, in this new phase, but apparently not one that is democratically elected by members of the very union who pay the administrator's wages, because the wages of everyone involved in the administration are paid by the union dues of CFMEU members, which is over, I think the administrator alone earns over $600,000. And Mark Irving KC will remain within the administration still, but just not running it. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. We are now going to hear a segment from last Tuesday's Tuesday Hometime show in which Jan Bartlett speaks with Binoy Kemp Mark about the US and Israel's attacks on Iran, Lebanon and Palestine and the consequences of Trump and Netanyahu staying in power for the world. Binoy Kemp Mark is a senior lecturer at RMIT focusing on international security, the war on terrorism, and politics.
As he had pointed out, the ongoing madness regarding Hummus, Lebanon, etc. And I'm interested in the fact that you used the word madness. I heard a Lebanese person this morning use the term, the moral contract is broken. How concerned are you about the world if Trump stays there?
As he stays further in office, it's very clear that certainly his grasp on political realities and you know, certainly when it comes to the Iran war has been remarkably, well, estranged, so to speak. I was going through the other day, actually, examining the various statements he's been making essentially since February 28th about the war and the various natures of it and his encounters with, you know, the way he describes the objectives, which, of course, they have no objectives to speak of. That's the problem. You know, it's one thing to embark on a conflict, but to do it in this particular way and have this strange assessment of reality has been very pernicious and globally, just, you know, very disruptive to say the least. And that's also in added to this, of course, the fact that we've got the Israeli dimension to this as well, which is really hampering the problems of seeking a resolution in the region. So we have this strange situation where words simply are not what they are. A ceasefire is not really a ceasefire. It's because there are qualifications to it. A closure is not really a closure. An opening is not really an opening, and this is in reference to the Strait of Hormuz, of course, where on the one day the Trump administration says there's a closure, and the next day, well, no, actually ships are still passing through. The Iranians, of course, respond by saying, well, actually there is a closure, but there hasn't really ever been one, technically. It's just that we're permitting vessels that we have allowed to go through. the circumstances are very peculiar, and of course, are bound to do anyone's head in after a while looking at this. But what is very unsettling is that there is no sight, actually, in terms of the resolution of the Iran war as we speak. The latest development is an odd one as well, which is in keeping with the whole business, which is that Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff have both gone to Islamabad, or at least if they're not, they're already there on their way. The Iranians have already arrived there, so they're meant to conduct yet another round of talks, although the Iranians have said they will not do so directly with the Americans on this occasion. Understandably, there's no reason for them to trust this. There seems to be a pattern here where talks take place, they don't seem to resolve anything, and then the bombing either resumes or is started. So the latest developments are in keeping with the peculiarity of the whole thing.
Well, let's stay with Netanyahu for a few minutes. I mean, how dangerous is he?
Oh, very, because what is happening at the moment is that for all the maneuverings that are taking place and the claimed progress and whatnot from the Trump administration, from Washington and so on, the Netanyahu government is continuing its program of, if you like, the Greater Enlargement Program, the Greater Israel Project, whatever you want to call it, in the sense, and this is where the ceasefire, to go back to what I was saying before, the problem with the word ceasefire, the word ceasefire in this case, Trump was trumpeting, as it were, the fact that this is now a three-week ceasefire that he's managed to wangle, in the Lebanese-Israel conflict. But what is very strange about it is that the Israelis are still conducting strikes, and the Israelis are also still conducting these operations which they deployed with such devastation and with exterminative effect, which is detonations of whole infrastructure and buildings and so on. And by any definition, that would actually constitute a war crime, but the particular operations are continuing in the south of Lebanon. Netanyahu has made it very clear that a ceasefire does not mean that operations will stop. So what on earth does it then mean? It should also, in addition to that, in the last 24 hours, there were strikes across Gaza, leaving 12 Palestinians dead. And there has been supposedly a ceasefire in place since October last year. So it's a very strange state of affairs where, even though the ceasefire is supposedly in place, war continues. The Israeli campaign continues essentially uninterrupted. So it's almost as if the ceasefire is providing a shield for the pursuit of greater Israel as a policy. And it should also be added, just to, in addition to that, the passage of laws that are, the ongoing passage of laws that are discriminatory and targeting of Palestinians, including, of course, the death penalty law that was passed by the Knesset at the end of last month, when the Knesset essentially passed a law decreeing that individuals would be sentenced to death for terrorism against the Jewish state and against Jews. But it would only apply in the West Bank, and it would only apply to Palestinians. It would not apply to Greater Israel, and it would not apply to Israeli citizens at all. So if that's not a definition of a discriminatory regime that amounts to apartheid, I don't know what is. So broadly speaking, Netanyahu is a very dangerous figure, because it should also be added that he has recently made it very clear that he wants to resume the bombing of Iran. And in fact, the Israelis are very eager to see any talks that take place between Iran and the U.S. fail. That is, bellicosity, war crime tendencies, you name it. And we've got the full lot there with Netanyahu and his officials.
Do you believe if, for any reason, Trump was no longer there, that Netanyahu would still have full reign?
Well, that's of course, the great, counterfactual, isn't it? We can't really answer that. But it is clear, though, that under Trump, he has been given free rein to do things that have not been given to any extent, the same degree, from other presidents. And it's very clear that during, for example, the Obama administration, it was a very tense period with Netanyahu, because Obama clearly did not get on with him. And even though Israeli policies were still being pursued that were discriminatory and oppressive, that the idea of having what we've seen happen to the extent is just hard to fathom. With Biden, of course, it was clear that there were some efforts made, not very good ones, to rein in the Israeli campaign in Gaza and things like that. But it is very clear that the Trump administration is very sympathetic. They did, after all, appoint a Christian Zionist in the form of the former Arizona governor, Mike Huckabee, who's also openly admitted essentially his sympathy for Greater Israel. And he was outed, as it were, so to speak, and probably incautious remarks made in an interview with Tucker Carlson. Under Trump, yes, Netanyahu feels very confident that he can get away with, quite literally, with murder. And in some cases, he's even encouraged to.
He's been building up to this for a long, long time, hasn't he?
Yes. So, for example, in terms of the notion of the Iranian threat, Netanyahu has been mentioning this essentially since the 90s. And in fact, what is interesting, it would be nice to do an analysis of statements he's made about Iran as a nuclear threat, a sequence of comments and chronological remarks about it over the years to demonstrate that Iran was just about to make an atomic weapon or nuclear weapon just around the corner. And it's interesting how often that was the case. And I think the absurdity of that reasoning was unveiled all too well by the attacks from February 28th this year, when apparently the 12-day war in which Israel and the United States bombed Iranian nuclear facilities, that was meant to be a spectacularly successful operation, it was clear that, well, apparently it wasn't that spectacularly successful. So it's a very strange situation here where we have Israel making it very clear that they do not want to make efforts with their particular regional powers in a sense of, well, they will, but on their terms, obviously. And they're very clear that within the proximate area of their borders, they're going to have some kind of greater buffer zones. They're doing it in Syria, for example. They've seized territory there, which is beyond the standard line in the Golan Heights. They're obviously very keen on essentially not annexing, then occupying southern Lebanon. And we can already see what's happening in the disaster of Gaza in terms of the peculiar nature of what's being the administration there. And we can broadly see the general regional policies. So it has been in the works for a very long time. And unfortunately, the very bitter fruit is now being, as it were, plucked.
And it's so dangerous, really, when you've got two belligerent leaders like Trump and Netanyahu who disregard virtually the whole of the UN. And you think how many times you've heard the word, that's another war crime, and it seems to just roll off them.
Well, yes. Well, they've made it very clear that international institutions are not to be taken seriously on their part. They've made it very clear. And there's been a collusion between Israel and the United States about libeling institutions such as the International Criminal Court, libeling the UN Human Rights Commission, libeling the UN Secretary General, libeling the UN General Assembly, you name it. Every single part of the UN has been seen as anti-Semitic and seen essentially as inconsequential as well. So on the one hand, this is the classic description of the UN, which I've written about before. On the one hand, a body like that is seen as ineffectual, as Trump keeps saying. It doesn't do anything. It supposedly can't secure peace the way he does, which is a big laugh. But on the other hand, it's dangerous in the sense that it intrudes in the affairs of other countries. So we've got this strange dynamic that both the Trump administration and the Netanyahu government seem to like to peddle. But the great tragedy in all of this, and I think it's worth reminding your listeners as well, is that these are the same individuals who are very happy to destroy and tarnish international law in a heartbeat, and then the audience, for example, and I include the Albanese government here, and I include the European Union, I include the Commissioner Ursula von der Leyen, and so on, they will still talk about the rules-based order. They will still talk about international law, but they will always condemn Iran, for example. They will condemn China. They will condemn Russia. But they will be very careful about the way they deal with U.S.-Israeli approaches to Iran. So I find that sort of an absolute travesty as well.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, streaming live on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au on 855 AM on the dial, of course, for those of us with a physical radio, and also streaming live on the Community Radio Plus app, which is actually my favorite way to listen to 3CR because, you know, someone once explained podcasts to me as like the sushi of information. Like, you can listen to it, you can eat it on the go, and it's always appropriate, you know what I mean? So the Community Radio Plus app really allows you to just consume 3CR wherever you are, and like sushi, it's always a good idea. Anyway, that was the first half of a conversation that Jan Bartlett from the Tuesday Hometime show had with senior lecturer at RMIT Binoy Kampmark about the US and Israel's attacks on Iran, Lebanon, and Palestine, and yeah, sort of how long Netanyahu has been working to be able to be so brazen about committing genocide on the global stage. We're going to hear the second half of that conversation in just a moment, but for now I thought I'd play a song. This is a song called Jangan Bicara Solidaritas from the Indonesian band Sukatani Punk.
Oh,
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the Apartheid Free Zone movement.
Pride Victoria is a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to equality and justice for multigender attracted people, including bi, pan, regardless of label, or no label at all. We organise community events and advocate for better policies and services. I Plus Pride runs discussion groups which offer a safe and fun space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your sexual identity, and provide peer support. I Plus Pride is especially keen to hear from multi-gender attracted people in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to I Plus Pride are tax deductible. For more information, visit our website at biplusprideVic.org.au, email info@biplusprideVic.org.au, or find us on Facebook or Instagram.
A 3CR supporter.
I'm bisexual. You're
listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial. That song that we heard before those announcements was Jangan Bakara Solidaritas. Apologies if I'm butchering that for any Indonesian people listening. by the band Sukatani. They're from Indonesia and they are actually playing at the Last Chance Rock and Roll Bar on Tuesday, this 5th of May. It's $25 cash at the door, and you can't buy them online. You can't buy tickets online. I would love to be at their gig. They actually had one of their songs has been sort of completely removed from streaming services because the song Baya Baya Baya, which translates to Pay Pay Pay, because it calls out the Indonesian police, I believe. It accuses them of corruption. And so basically, I think this is 2 or 3 years ago now, they were forced to, take the song off of streaming services completely everywhere, ask people to remove videos of them playing the song live on the internet, and then also they had to release an apology video on their Instagram. Yeah, wild stuff. Just to make a claim that the police force is corrupt. Who would have thought? Anyway, we're going to keep going with the second half of the conversation between Jan Bartlett and Bino Kapmark, who is a senior lecturer at RMIT, focusing on international security, the war on terrorism, and politics. This second part focuses on fractures in the Republican Party and the MAGA movement against Trump's war on Iran because of his ties to Israel and what both countries are doing in Iran. And they also talk about changing attitudes towards fossil fuels because of just what a nightmare the Strait of Hormuz actions or activities or things happening in the Strait of Hormuz have been for big oil. God forbid that they lose some money. Anyway.
Why are they so frightened?
In the Australian context and in the EU context, there is still this ongoing realization, or there is the sense that the United States remains, as it were, preeminent power. And in Australia, it's particularly problematic because of its deepening and I think tragically deepening ties in security-wise with the United States, where essentially imbecilic arrangements on security have been made regarding, of course, the AUKUS pact, an absurd arrangement which is distorting payment and expenditure in Australia in the budget, but also the military budget as well. And it's also problematic because of the security ties. And I think this is the thing. The United States always markets itself as an indispensable provider of security. It allows people to access its, for example, its intelligence reserves and whatnot. It has Pine Gap in Australia, and it gives the impression that Australia has prized access to incredible gold reserves of security and intelligence material, and that's one of the ways it sort of buys loyalty, if you like. So a country like Australia is very much in a bind and terrified about saying anything that will be construed as a negative thing, and you know, you don't even have to say anything negative, of course, and Trump will openly excoriate allies, and as he has to with Australia a couple of times. In fact, several times he's mentioned Australia along with South Korea, along with any number of countries that have not supposedly contributed any efforts to opening the Strait of Hormuz. I think this kind of balletic approach to Trump is a very absurd one, and it's very demeaning as well, and it's certainly not delivering any results at all from a perspective like Australia, and let alone the EU.
Well, look, the world can't keep going on like it is, with people being killed all over the Middle East, and people are going hungry because they can't get their fertilizer and their oil, and there are dire predictions that if this war continues, that a lot more people are going to suffer. Could it be the November elections that will pull him up, or is there any other way to pull him up, in a sense?
Well, I know there are efforts being made, which will no doubt fail, as they have before. The Democrats are trying to, in the United States, they're trying to sort of enact provisions which they hope can be used to essentially deem the commander-in-chief, in other words, Trump, unfit. But I don't see that particular experiment going anywhere. One of the things that is interesting about, you were mentioning, of course, the fact that the crisis in terms of fertilizers, and of course the obvious ongoing crisis with the rise in prices across the board, and certainly it's going to be critically affecting, broadly speaking, the global south and so on. One of the things that I think is interesting, with the November elections, and I don't necessarily, they're a bit hard to read. On paper, it looks like the Republicans are going to get a trouncing in certain areas, but and they are rather afraid. I think it's very evident that in some circles, some of the Republicans, the so-called MAGA types, they're also disagreeing about these policies. So the way I see it, the greatest hope about change really is within MAGA itself, is within the Make America Great Again movement, to persuade Trump that particular base is not as reliably stable as it has been before. The war is certainly the Iran war is enormously unpopular in the United States and even amongst Republicans. So there has been a core constituency of loyalty there for Trump, but it's even becoming clearer now, depending on which poll you consult, that support is eroding there. And when you've got, even though they're sort of being dismissed in some circles, individuals such as Tucker Carlson, for example, are being dismissed as not necessarily representative, I think they are dismissed at the peril of genuine analysis, because I do think that particular movement has sway, more sway than perhaps people realize regarding Trump. So there is that thing that I hope will develop sooner rather than later, that influence.
But as his health deteriorates, and it will deteriorate, we need something else as well, don't we?
Well, yes, absolutely. But I think when we do speak about these things, I try to find the silver lining if it's possible. But I think there is one interesting silver lining, though, that's developed just quite literally as we speak, and that is that countries are now starting to realize that with the role being played in the Strait of Hormuz on energy and prices and you know, being, as it's called, a global choke point, there has been a revived interest in revisiting the issue of the use of fossil fuels and the use of oil, petroleum and products and so on. And that's really interesting. And it's and why do I say that? You know, we've seen the COP, series of COP talks, climate change talks, essentially stagger along and limp along. You know, last year's COP 30 in Brazil was could hardly be said to be much of a success at all. And yet we have 60 countries gathering in Colombia, including Australia, which is interesting. I didn't expect that. So a number of fossil fuel countries as well, including Colombia and in Nigeria and so on. And these countries are actually considering transitioning away from fossil fuels. It's openly on the agenda in a way that is not, you know, at the COP agenda meetings, you always have a very dominant fossil fuel lobby that's doing the rounds. But in this particular gathering in Colombia, what they're doing is trying to, you know, generate a plan by which countries, you know, to wean themselves off fossil fuels so that we don't have another Strait of Hormuz problem again. Now, that is actually quite interesting. I don't know where this will go, and I don't know whether necessarily this is going to add more impetus other than pageantry. But I think it's worth noting that this crisis is creating an increased interest in renewables, in other forms of generating energy and so forth, and security. So this is something to keep an eye on.
I'm glad we got a little bit of a positive ending, Binoy.
And that was Jan Bartlett from the Tuesday Hometime show speaking with Binoy Campmark about Iran and the US and Israel. And that second part of the conversation was talking about fractures within the Republican Party and the MAGA movement because of the US's, you know, unfaltering support of Israel and both countries' actions in Iran. Towards the end, they speak about potentially changing global attitudes towards fossil fuels because of what is happening in the Strait of Hormuz. It's interesting that they mentioned the COP 30. I always forget that the number at the end of the COP refers to how many conferences they've had. So that's the 30th one. And every time I remember that, I just think, wow, what has been achieved? Like, genuinely, what has been achieved after 30 years of, like, countries gathering to talk about the climate? Like, we're still in a climate crisis and we're still exhausted and exploited because of continual extraction under colonialism and capitalism. Anyway, you can listen to more from Jan Bartlett on Tuesdays, of course, from 4 to 6 p.m., or you can go to 3cr.org.au/Tuesday Hometime to listen to the rest of that conversation or any previous episodes from the Tuesday Hometime show. We're going to go to a track real quick before we head into our next segment. This song is called Empire's Demise by Baltimore hardcore band End It. We'll be right back.
Kefirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefirs.org.au. That's kefirs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your app.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. The song you heard before those announcements was called Empire's Demise by the Baltimore hardcore band Ended. I was fortunate enough to see them earlier this year, late last year. Yeah, super special, and I've been listening to that album, Wrong Side of Heaven, a lot, and I really enjoy, same as that Tsukutani songs that really just anchor me politically, like really reminds me that like, hey, like you don't have to be the loudest in the room and just like put your head down and do the work. And I really love hardcore punk music for that. Speaking of doing the work, we are now going to, given it was May Day on Friday, and because of 3CR's coverage of May Day, dedicated May Day coverage on both Friday and Sunday, we are going to take a little journey into 3CR's archives to hear a segment from the Gay Liberation Radio show back in 1977, the 20th of April 1977, to be exact. In this segment, host Carl speaks with another member of the Gay Liberation Front about being a working class homosexual. Here it is.
I think one of the things we'll start with, Bruce, one of the things I've noticed in Gay Liberation in the last year is that we now have a couple at least of people that consider themselves working class homosexuals. Yes, and right. I'd put you into this category. Do you want to talk a bit about that? How have you found Gay Lib in that regard, and how do you find sexuality in the working class, especially on homosexuality?
Well, homosexuality in the working class, I think, is very much suppressed. You don't hear much about them in any way or form. It's mostly the people such as university students, people this like that you hear a lot about. People in the, call the pen and paper people. But as people that do manual work, you very rarely hear anything about them. They do exist, but they're very, very quiet.
Yeah, it's obvious to me that they exist in all classes. Homosexuality, I've often thought, is something that does, more than anything else I know, cross all classes. But like you said, in the working class, it's probably more suppressed than anywhere else. Have you got any explanations you might think for that?
Well, I think it's the old thing, if we don't talk about it, it might go away attitude. These people that are gays in the working class, well, they don't want to talk about the subject to their parents or friends on account of they might get ridiculed and perhaps lose their job, friends, all this type of thing. So they sort of just keep quiet about it, sort of think, well, it might go away if we don't say anything about it.
Well, you'd produce this that a lot of ignorance, and perhaps more ignorance than there is in...
Yes, I think it's more ignorance on the part of the working class gays about the thing. They should sort of, come out a bit more than what they do.
Yeah, I can understand the reasons, though. I think the...
Yeah, it's on account of the possibility of, you know, losing friends, employment and so forth.
That sort of leads me up to the next thing I'm going to talk about. It's that your work life, and very much in the workplace, I've found in the past that we do have two faces if we're homosexuals, that we're, in fact we either have to become very good actors or... how have you found this yourself? Like, is there anyone that you can be honest with at work?
Yes, there's a few of the my workmates that I have been honest with. In fact, strange enough, it's the older people. The people that I've told that I'm gay, they sort of stand back in astonishment. I say, "You're not." I said, "Yes, of course I am." "Oh, you're pulling my leg." No, fair digging. And they just can't grasp. And then, you know, of course, you go into detail a bit, and of course they usually accept it. In fact, one chap in particular, John the Storeman, he's very good at it. In fact, quite often you'll see something written up in the newspapers, and you'll cut it out or bring the paper out to him. He'll say, "Oh, here's something about your crowd, you know." And I say, "Oh, good, terrific, you know." So he's really accepted it really well.
Did you sort of have a friendship going there before you talk about
that? Oh, yes. I was very friendly with this particular storeman, and I found that I could, you know, take him into my confidence. Mainly, he took me into his confidence with, you know, a couple of matters that he had on the go, so I told him about myself then.
But in the major sort of part of your work day, it'd be something that's denied to you. You wouldn't be able to sort of, like... One man I know that's sort of done it for himself, when he's out with another workmate and they're sort of ogling women, he makes it very obvious that, no, there's a guy up the street there he finds very attractive. Is that sort of something that you could indulge in at your workplace?
Yes, I could. Quite a few of the, well, you know, work friends, I could, you know, sort of have it all for them, but of course, the place of work you don't play up.
Yeah. What about other things inside work? Do you find yourself quite, like, does your work involve, you're involved with tradies and people like that, I believe?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. What about the younger people that you know?
Well, 18-year-olds and one's apprentices? Got to be an actor. For instance, if you're in a vehicle with somebody and they're saying, "Gee, you know, she's all right. You know, she could be no bit of all right." And I say, "Oh, yeah, she would be all right. And I've got to put a big act on." Of course, a lot of them, you know, can't see through this, and I can just go on and carry it through that way. In fact, at times I feel I should be given the Academy Award for some of this sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, look,
a big act bit on it. So I'd like to see some of the general working class people join up with organisations and let their voice be heard, mainly for the change in the laws which will be coming up in the state parliament in the near future.
Well, thanks very much, Bruce. That's all we've got time for, and I think that's a great bit of advice. I'd like to see a lot more working class homosexuals be upfront with Gay Liberation and various other organisations.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That was a very short segment from the 20th of April 1977 from the Gay Liberation Radio, in which the host Carl speaks with another member of the Gay Liberation Front about being a working class homosexual. So yeah, I thought I'd play that given Friday was May Day. And of course, you can listen to 3CR's dedicated May Day broadcasts on both Friday and Sunday on the 3CR website. I believe there's a full page where folks can listen back to so much of that content. Yeah, I actually found that audio at the Australian Queer Archives in St Kilda. So, yeah, a big thank you to the Australian Queer Archives for providing me providing us with that audio. Yeah, super, super special, especially as a working class queer person, to be able to hear that audio and, yeah, to hear their experiences of what it was like back then. And, yeah, I do feel there's a lot of parallels with what they said and my own experiences, especially working in construction. Yeah, so, and I would like to reiterate the message at the end there. If you're a working class queer, join the movement for queer liberation. Your place is very much welcome in the movement for queer liberation. Up next, we are going to be listening to the last of our regular monthly segment called Tiny Sparks and Turning Points, which is a historical bulletin from our good friends at the Common Social Change Library. They've been providing us with this bulletin for a year now, and it features a look at some radical events over the year that changed the country. This month is obviously looking at the month of May for important things that happened across the continent. Here it is.
Tiny Sparks and Turning Points is a monthly selection of protests, strikes and significant dates concerning social change in Australian history. This segment is presented by the Commons Social Change Library, a repository of more than 1,500 resources for campaigners, which can be found at commonslibrary.org.
As part of global commemoration celebrating workers' power and protesting the sentencing of Chicago labour activists to death, Australian anarchists and other radicals held the nation's first May Day celebrations on the 1st of May, 1887. The shift from private to public events occurred with a march in Brisbane 4 years later, where around 1,000 people attended a rally, some marching with blue sashes and Eureka flags. Thereafter, May Day grew in importance and size across Australia as an annual event.
On the 1st of May 2001, thousands of people took part in a May the 1st May Day march in Melbourne, successfully closing down the Stock Exchange.
On the 2nd of May 1974, Melbourne students at RMIT held a one-day strike and occupied Storey Hall, demanding better facilities and a union building.
On the 2nd of May 2007, environmentalists blockaded trucks at Chillora, which were transporting cyanide to the Barrick gold mine at Lake Cowell.
On the 5th of May 1980, 30 people were arrested during a demonstration against Western Australia's 54B anti-protest laws. These made it illegal to convene public meetings of more than three people without a police permit.
On the 5th of May 2014, university students disrupted an appearance by then Education Minister Christopher Pyne on the ABC's Q&A program. Protesting against university fees, they unfurled a banner that read, "More brains, not warplanes."
Hospitality and other staff at various cafes, tea rooms, hotels and restaurants across Melbourne quit work on the 6th of May 1912 in protest after the state government set minimum conditions that maintained a 56-hour working week for women and 58 hours for men.
On May the 6th, but in 2005, anti-war protesters picketed ANZ offices in Adelaide to highlight the bank's involvement in the occupation of Iraq.
On the 7th of May 1893, 600 unemployed people rallied in Broken Hill, insisting the government pass the Menindi Tramway Act to provide work for the 2,000 jobless in the region.
On the 8th of May 1997, 1,500 students marched against fees for university degrees before a number went on to occupy the administration building at the University of Melbourne.
On the 8th and 9th of May 1970, hundreds of thousands of people took part in Vietnam moratorium campaign marches calling for an end to conscription and Australian involvement in the war. People from all walks of life participated in the marches, which were held across the country, drawing around 100,000 participants in Melbourne and over 40,000 in Sydney. Despite much media hype regarding violence, including 1,000 police being deployed in Melbourne, the events were peaceful. These were the biggest protests held in Australia to the time.
On the 9th of May, 1903, the first ever strike by Victorian state government employees took place when railway workers walked off the job, demanding the right to join a union.
On the 9th of May, 1919, a funeral for Tom Edwards brought Fremantle to a standstill. The unionists had been killed by police 5 days earlier when a party of police, led by the Premier Hal Colbatch, brought a flotilla of boats into Fremantle Harbour to break up a wharf strike and install barricades to allow the SS Dimboola to be unloaded by non-unionists. The ship was being picketed as unionists were concerned it had not been properly quarantined and could expose their community to the then-raging flu pandemic.
On the 10th of May 1946, wharfies who had been locked out of their workplace due to an industrial dispute, forced their way onto the docks to unload fruit for the people of Brisbane.
On the 10th of May 1989, unionists began a 14-week occupation of Sydney's Cockatoo Island shipyard. This followed the Department of Defence's decision to sell a facility which had been a major Australian shipbuilding hub since 1857.
On the 13th of May 1932 in Sydney, hundreds of picketers forced police and bailiffs to abandon the eviction of a household in Surry Hills.
On the 14th of May 1973, the Australian Council of Trade Unions placed bans on transport and communications with France until that country called off or completed nuclear testing in the Pacific.
On the 15th of May 1808, 50 convicts seized the brig Harrington in Farm Cove, Sydney, and escaped to the Philippines.
On the 15th of May, but in 1969, Victorian Tramways union leader Clary O'Shea was jailed by the Industrial Court for refusing to allow it access to the union's accounts. The union had been fined under anti-union penal powers for undertaking industrial action. The jailing triggered a wave of strikes across Australia with around 1 million workers taking part until O'Shea was freed 6 days later.
On the 15th of May 1974, members of the Black Caucus erected an Aboriginal tent embassy in Brisbane's King George Square, demanding better housing for First Nations people.
On the 15th of May 2014, the people of the Northern Rivers scored a major victory against the expansion of the coal and gas industry in their region, when the New South Wales government cancelled resources company Metgasco's licence to drill at Bentley. This followed concerted campaigning which had built up a blockade of the drilling site that was able to draw on up to 10,000 participants.
On the 16th of May 2008, 300 seniors blocked the Flinders Street Station intersection in central Melbourne, calling for the pension to be set at 35% of average weekly earnings.
On the 17th of May 1834, George Lovelace became the last of the Tolpuddle martyrs to be transported from Britain to Australia for the crime of forming a union.
On the 17th of May 1982, 4 days of protest at South Australia's Honeymoon uranium mine ended with a 90-minute occupation of the main compound.
On the 18th of May 1977, hundreds of cyclists from across the country arrived in Canberra to protest against uranium mining.
On the 18th of May 2014, tens of thousands of people rallied around Australia against government austerity and cutbacks as part of the Bust the Budget protests.
In 1933, Brunswick became the centre of a civil liberties campaign against police breaking up public meetings and protests in Melbourne. While the local council resisted banning street rallies, police arrested speakers in Phoenix Street using vague traffic laws. On the 19th of May, activists used a decoy speaker and a caged lorry from which artist Noel Coonahan addressed gathered crowds about free speech and unemployment. Despite police violence, the protest embarrassed authorities, forcing them to once more allow street speaking in the suburb.
On May the 19th, 1998, protesters began a 2-week blockade by shutting the gates to the Northern Territory's Ranger uranium mine.
On the 20th of May 1853, shipwrights in Sydney began a strike for an increase in wages. After a meeting of the trade was held, magistrates issued warrants against organisers for conspiracy and engaging in a combination. Newspapers who had previously hailed the law of supply and demand in relation to wages now complained of, quote, unfair demands and the unhealthy independence of many of the working classes. The prosecutions did not go forward and the shipwrights obtained their pay rise.
On the 20th of May, 1997, 20,000 construction unionists went on strike over safety after a worker was killed on the Melbourne CityLink worksite.
On the 23rd of May 1990, 700 students rallied at the University of Tasmania against plans to cut funding for the Faculty of Arts.
On the 23rd of May 2004, the Flotilla of Hope left Brisbane to sail to Nauru to highlight the suffering of the 260 refugees detained there.
On the 24th of May 1945, Woman magazine failed to appear after female bookbinders employed by the Associated Press in Sydney defied a government order to end their strike.
On the 25th of May 2014, 250 people marched through Tennant Creek in opposition to government plans to build a nuclear waste dump at Muckaty Station.
On the 26th of May 1890, 600 bootmakers across Brisbane struck for better rates of pay, limits on child labour, and an end to outsourcing. Public meetings were held throughout the strike, with one at the Gaiety Theatre drawing 1,000 attendees. After 16 days, employers surrendered, giving up major concessions.
On the 26th of May, but in 1998, the first National Sorry Day was held to acknowledge the trauma and grief experienced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children who were forcibly removed from their families, communities, and culture by government policies.
On the 28th of May 1978, members of the Disabled People's Action Forum blockaded the entrance to a Melbourne Medibank claims office for an hour to highlight the inaccessibility of this and many other buildings.
On the 28th of May 2000, 250,000 people marched across the Sydney Harbour Bridge in a show of support for reconciliation with First Nations.
On the 29th of May 1859, the Victorian Trades Hall Council building was opened in Melbourne, with a party attended by over 1,000 unionists and their supporters.
On the 29th of May 2000, unions across Australia imposed bans on freight and flights to Fiji following a coup in that country.
On the 29th of May 2011, 3,000 people rallied at Wollongong's Ostonmer Beach. The crowd formed a human sign reading Stop Coal Seam Gas as part of calls for a moratorium on fracking in the Illawarra region.
On the 30th of May 2012, more than 500 people marched silently to Parliament House in Melbourne to protest the discontinuation of Victoria's only diploma in Auslan, the national language for the hearing impaired.
On the 31st of May 1972, thousands of secondary school students in Melbourne struck and marched for youth rights and improved educational facilities.
On the 31st of May 2000, truck owner drivers blockaded the Cunningham Highway between Brisbane and Toowoomba as part of a national campaign for improved pay rates.
You've been listening to Tiny Sparks and Turning Points. To find out more about the history of social change in Australia, you can visit commonslibrary.org.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. As they said at the end of that segment, that was Tiny Sparks and Turning Points, brought to us by our comrades at the Common Social Change Library. We've been airing that regular segment on the first Monday of every month for the past year, and that was the last of that regular segment, but luckily you can go back and listen to every one of those segments from the past year on the 3CR website by searching Tiny Sparks and Turning Points on 3cr.org.au. Absolutely check out the Commons Social Change Library's website. They have an amazing, for further reading on events that changed the continent from a left-wing perspective, you can search from Little Things, Big Things Grow, events that changed Australia at commonslibrary.org. I will put the link to both both of those on the 3CR website for the podcast that we publish. It is 20 minutes past 8 in the morning, and we are just going to go to a quick track before we head into our last segment of the show. This is Daydreaming by the great Aretha Franklin.
Don't miss Future Country, the country road in NGV First Nations Commission's exhibition, now showing at NGV Australia. See new work by 8 emerging First Nations artists from around Australia who've been guided by esteemed industry mentors to present their most ambitious works to date. From weaving and photography to sculpture and possum skin cloak making, experience these powerful works in this free exhibition, open daily until 13 September. Learn more at ngv.melbourne.
A 3CR supporter.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. That song before those announcements was, of course, Daydreaming by the great Aretha Franklin. I listened to that song literally on repeat on the way to the show this morning. So if anybody saw me on the tram, just in my own world, I was listening to Aretha Franklin. It is 25 minutes past 8. We've only got a few minutes left of the Monday Breakfast Show for this week. We're going to close out the show with some content from last year's Beyond the Bars, which is, if you aren't aware for some reason, is 3CR's prison broadcast that we do every year for the past couple of years in the first week, in NAIDOC week, which is the first full week in July, and we'll be doing the same this year. But anyway, this is some content from last year's Beyond the Bars broadcast. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. That was a little performance by Amos, Brent and Zach, which is featured on the 2025 iteration of the 3CR's Beyond the Bars broadcast, which will once again be taking place in NAIDOC Week in July. We've only got a few moments left of the Monday Breakfast Show, so I will leave it here. But for now, stay tuned for Women on the Line. We will see you next week.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.